Welcome back to the Anarcho Book Club. So, if you guys were following me on Mastodon, you'll know I've been talking a little bit about the book we've read for this week. And it's more of an essay, really, but it's been turned into a book form called Against Intellectual Property by Stephen Kinsella. And I wanted to hit on some of the highlights of the essay, or of the book, more than go into depth, like I often do, as you've probably noticed, with most of the books we've read. I was thinking about this before I started recording. It's sort of kind of the tactic I want to take with this podcast, so that I'm not just giving you a rundown of individual books and why they should be important to you. I don't want to just give you a boiled down version of the book in audio form, because I'd rather you read them, especially books like this that delve deeply into fundamental ideas that modern American capitalism has embodied. So we're going to just hit a few highlights, but first let's introduce the author. Stephen Kinsella is an attorney in Houston, director of the Center for the Study of Innovative Freedom, and editor of Libertarian Papers. And he is an avowed libertarian anarchist, focusing more on the conservative sect of anarchy. I'm not really sure, I don't really know a whole lot about Stephen Kinsella, but I would venture to guess that he is an anarcho-capitalist. So he has the background of Mises and Rothbard and, I believe, Hoppe. And he's written a few other papers, or I don't know what, yeah, I think essays. One, The Voluntarist Constitution, which if you know much about anarcho-capitalism or anarcho-capitalists, you'll know that one of the names that they go by, part of the more center group, would be voluntarist. And these are what some would classify as kind of, and I use this term very loosely, extremist sorts of anarchists. Voluntarists tend to be, they tend to be anarcho-capitalists, and they tend to kind of find their roots, their foundation in Mises and Rothbard, the roots of their philosophies, that is. Some of them have come from the Randian tradition, the Ayn Rand tradition of libertarianism, and they still, the ones I know, I should put it this way, the voluntarists that I know, a lot of them have come from the Ayn Rand philosophy. Well, Ayn Rand, if you know anything about Ayn Rand, which I would like to cover one of her books in the future, even though she's strictly not an anarchist, she does have a lot of philosophies that I believe would benefit the worldview of an anarchist, would help to expand the perceptions of you, my fellow anarchists. So, but we'll get to that another time, maybe. And it may be way down the road, because there are a lot of other anarchists that I want to cover before we start getting into that type of literature. So, let's kind of delve into the high points I've kind of singled out from Against Intellectual Property. And the first thing you'll notice whenever you're reading this, it does sound like an essay. It's written in a more short form than something like a long form book. The last thing we read was from Rothbard, and it was an excerpt from a very long form series of books, or a long form 5-volume set of his work. And so it progresses a lot more quickly, this Against Intellectual Property. And so I wanted to look up some things that other people have said about it, and not just have my perception, my ideas on it to go on. And so I was looking up some things last night and this morning before I recorded this, and oddly enough, or funnily enough, maybe, I could find a few things, but most of the things I found were on sites like JSTOR and WorldCat that very strictly keep everything locked behind copyright protections. So I got a few excerpts. There's one called The Case Against Intellectual Property. It's not about this book, but it is about the same concept. And of course, they only give me one page that I can read from. And that's not very helpful, so I don't have a lot of supporting materials for this that are in depth. I have a lot of, I found a lot of like social media posts and so on, things like that. But that's not really what I was going for. So let's just dive into it. In the opening of the book, Kinsella describes the different ideas within intellectual property rights, copyrights, and patents, and things like that. And he goes through, and in lawyer form, as he is a copyright lawyer, in good form, he goes through and describes them and lays out his terms. He lays out what each of these things are, and that covers a very large section of this essay or this book. But it does give you an idea of what we're dealing with before he starts making an argument against it, and which I think is fantastic. Although I've read this book before, so I kind of already knew these things, it was a good refresher on what a copyright was, or a patent, or, you know, whatever, a trademark I think he covers as well. And it was a good refresher, because then you launch into his argument against these sorts of things. He makes a moral argument, but also a reasonable argument against these tools of the state. And that is one thing we should note, and this is one of the things that I did write down as I was reading, that he does focus very heavily on the state. And the state has created these tools. And okay, so let's step back. So at the founding of the United States, one of the great concerns was the public-private partnerships that may form, and how large corporations, or in that time, things like the East India Trade Company, the founders wanted to make safeguards against influence from massive corporations, or, and they may have not seen it as massive corporations, they see it as influence from outside sources that are powerful, be it the king of another country or a massive corporation, as we see today. However, they did include something, they included the option for the government to issue patents for protection of a producer or of an inventor's intellectual property. And maybe they didn't go into it and specifically name it as intellectual property. I think that came much later. But they did give the power of patents to the government. And just to kind of spell out what that means, a patent is the government saying you are allowed to have a full monopoly on this idea, or on this, well, Kinsella describes it best, which is why I always urge you to read the book beforehand, so that you know what we're talking about. But it is the state giving a virtual monopoly, as it were, to a single individual, or to a corporation, as we see with patent trolling with Google and Apple and Microsoft and all of the big tech companies, as well as manufacturing corporations. They also patent troll. They buy up patents so that no one else can produce what they're producing. And in effect, it gives them a monopoly. Now, I believe a lot of people may call it a virtual monopoly, but it's not virtual at all. There's nothing you can call it other than a monopoly. And the government creates these monopolies with patents, copyrights. They allow the creation, and then they protect them with the full force of the government. So you have the police, you have the army, the military, you have the all of the enforcement officers that enforce these copyrights and patents. And that's the only way these things can be upheld. It's the only way that we have, it's the only mechanism that we have, and by we, I should say they, it's the only mechanism that they have to enforce these things. It is through the threat of violence and the threat of force to enforce copyright. And that is one of the claims that Kinsella focuses on. And I've said it before, if you have to, if an idea that you have can only be upheld through force and violence and submission of those that you oppose, then is it really an idea worth holding? It seems to me that to hold such an idea and to enforce such an idea through those means, violence and threats of force, it would be something, it would be amoral to do such a thing. To uphold any sort of patent or copyright is a use of violence. It is a use of force. Now, some of you have contacted me on Mastodon, and you have kind of, you've given me something to think about. It was Zudlik Ravel Anon. I probably butchered that name, and I'm sorry. He said, if property is theft, then intellectual property is theft for the sake of theft. And I would not agree. I still am not convinced that I personally could make a case that property is theft. Proudhon made his case, and I'm sure there are others that I haven't read that make a much better case. But the case that Proudhon made, it wasn't very convincing to me, I think. I don't know how else to put it. It wasn't very convincing, the case that Proudhon made. And we won't go over that again. You can listen to that episode at your leisure. It is one of the first ones. I think it was number 4. So episode 003. Because we start from 0. His case just really didn't jive well with my own worldview or my own perception of the issue. But it is a good, if you are one who has come to know or come to believe that property is theft, then that is all you need to know. You don't need this book with the argument. You don't need the argument that Kinsella sets forth to call intellectual property theft or to make a case against intellectual property. You don't need that at all. But as for me, I do need some sort of an argument, because I know there's an innate knowledge, or an innate, I guess you would call it a feeling within, I get the feeling that whenever I consider intellectual property, something always has in the past seemed off to me about the justification for it. It doesn't seem right to me. It doesn't jive well with my own sense of morality. So I do need an argument against intellectual property. And I have found one with Kinsella. And it's a pretty good one. He lays out the case very boldly, very clearly and plainly, that intellectual property is in fact at least amoral, if not immoral, from the perspective of someone who believes in property rights, at least a framework of rights around property, a framework of rights around something, well, for example, and I don't mean to take out time from this podcast to lay out my ideas of property, not exactly, but for the sake of separating the two ideas, for example, where you live is a place that you have complete control over. And because you have that control over it, it is something in, at least in English and in other languages that I've studied, you call it possessively. You name it possessively. This is my home. This is my bed. This is my kitchen. Or this is my food. And I know that is sort of a weak argument to argue semantics, but there's something deeper, on a deeper level here, that is a you claim possession over certain things. Now, that argument, and the argument for that, which we can't get into because that would take an entire podcast on its own, the argument for that does not extend to things that you cannot control yourself with your own bodily power and mind. So, for instance, and I know there is a case for rental properties and things like that, but for instance, someone who rents out a piece of property or an apartment, they have indirect control over that property. Therefore, it is hard for me to make the argument that they own that property if they're allowing, say, a local government or a state to use force and the threat of force to assist him or her in owning that property, in possessing that property. Now, it gets a little bit shifty, a little bit dicey here, because if he can employ someone to protect that property for him, or to claim that property for him, that may be a good claim that he can, in fact, own that property. But this whole thing spins out of control whenever you get into a corporation like Google, who owns, it's got to be tens of thousands of acres of land, thousands of buildings, and it is an entity that is a non-human entity. It is an entity that is formed by humans, I guess, but it is an entity that is a creation. It is a creation of the mind. A corporation is nothing other than the creation of a mind. And this is where the meat of Kinsella's argument, I think, is. Although I don't remember if he touches on this very much, but the very idea of forming a corporation is a statist idea in and of itself. It is an abandon of personal responsibility. You create a corporation, for instance, and I've created one of these before, a limited liability corporation, or an LLC. Limited liability there, if you form one of these, if that corporation goes bankrupt, it is that entity that goes bankrupt, not you. Now, you do bear some responsibility for it, but you have effectively, through the invention of a governmental tool or the tools of the state, you have limited your risk through the creation of this, what would you call it, this non-real entity, this idea. It's a mere idea. I think you understand what I'm trying to say, but I don't know how to put it into words. It's this figment of their imagination, of whoever forms one of these, and it just protects them from the government, from excised by the government. It will just protect them from if they make bad decisions and their company goes under, goes bankrupt. They are now protected, and that is not something that is not a that is whenever a company goes under, that means it owes other people money that it cannot pay back. It owes other people notations of value, dollars in some cases, assets in other cases. That corporation or that person, I should say this, the owner of that corporation owes other people money. Whenever that owner decides, this was a failed attempt, we'll just declare bankruptcy. What they're doing in that moment is saying, okay, so in bankruptcy, they will have to pay some things, but those things will come out of the assets of that corporation. In a limited liability corporation, if I understand it correctly, none of the responsibility will fall on the personal assets of the human or the person that owns that corporation. It will all come from that LLC. And in doing so that means, since it is going bankrupt, it does not have enough value to pay off its creditors, to pay off the people that it owes money or assets to, or products. And so, anyone who has decided to lend this LLC some money, or some, give them an advance on paper cups, for instance, for, say, a coffee shop, or lids, or whatever, what have you, or they've given them an advance on maybe 30 pounds of coffee. Well, here's the rub. This company goes under. They've already used all that coffee. They can't give that coffee back, so they ask for goods in kind. Well, they've also used all of their paper cups. They've also used all of their allowances on water, and electricity that were also lent to them. So now they have to divvy up the remaining assets, which would be probably not the building, because they're probably renting that from someone. Maybe it is the coffee grinder and the coffee maker, the oven for the baked goods, and so on. But that's not going to amount to much. And now, whose fault is that it went under? Well, it is the fault of the business owner who did not have the foresight to see that his venture would fail. Now, see, that's part of the risk. However, he formed an LLC. He now has government protections against this risk. And so now all of these people that have lent him money or goods are losing out. And that's taking capital out of their each individual pocket. And it could be an actual person, not a corporation, that has lent these things to this coffee shop owner. That person is now losing out, and it's taking money, food, what have you, out of that person's pocket because he decided to deal with, or she, with a LLC entity. This redistribution of capital, well, in the end, the owner of the LLC ends up making out like a bandit. They don't have to worry about these things. Now, of course, they don't want this to happen, but the sting of failure does not cut so deep anymore because of an LLC. Now, what does this have to do with copyright? Well, it is a similar tool that is utilized by individuals to limit their liability and to maximize their personal profitability. And that's a problem, because the only way they do that is through the exploitation of others. And this is the problem. These are the things that it came to mind whenever I was reading through this essay once again, or this book. I really don't know what to call it, if it's an essay or a book, but we'll just call it a book from now on. These are the things that came to my mind as I read through this book. It is the very nature of a copyright is amoral or immoral in and of itself, because it steals from, well, let's take the side of things where I tend to go, the type of anarchism that I tend to be drawn towards. It steals from the common person. A copyright steals from them the ability to use something that they have acquired. For instance, whenever I was looking up articles to help me kind of understand a deeper concept of being against intellectual property rights. Not just against it, but just, I don't know, in the Greek you would just put an A in front of whatever it is that you're negating. To negate it, to negate the very belief in such an idea. So, property rights, I guess, or IP, or intellectual property rights. Just like amoral is without morals. This is my stance on it. And it's not just, I always had the kind of root ideation that the idea of intellectual property rights was flawed at its core. But now reading through this book, I have realized that it is indeed flawed. He lays out a very good argument for why it's flawed. Goes through every little point as to why the idea of intellectual property rights is flawed at its very core, just like the idea of forming a corporation, an LLC, whatever kind of corporation you'd like to form, that the whole concept behind it is flawed, because it necessitates a theft, or an eventual theft, or a probable future theft from those around, from the community. It is a theft. So IP is a theft of knowledge. Because now you're restricting something that is, you're restricting something that is not, what do they call it? You're restricting something that is ephemeral, something that is not tangible. You're restricting knowledge. JSTOR is one of the worst about this. They put a man in prison, and he eventually killed himself. Aaron Schwartz was his name, and he killed himself in prison by hanging. They put him in prison for the crime of stealing intellectual property. And it wasn't just JSTOR. There were a lot of others that were involved as well, but JSTOR is the megacorp that, that has the government's ear. And they use their power of copyrights and patents and everything else. And they got a man killed. One of the founders of Wikipedia. And if that doesn't shake you to your core, then you can go to prison simply for acquiring a digital copy of something. Something that has no inherent value, monetary value, that is. It has nothing to it unless assigned to it by a megacorp who can enforce that by sending a few men and women in blue costumes and with handcuffs and guns to your house, forcefully entering your house, putting those handcuffs on you at gunpoint. If you resist, they will shoot you. But if you don't resist, they'll take you in and they'll put you in a cage, you see. And what was your crime? You looked at something on your computer. You looked at something you didn't pay for. You didn't pay the tax to the megacorp, to JSTOR, to whomever it is. You didn't pay that tax, and now you're going to go to jail. And I'm sorry. But they're not sorry. This is how they hold their power, and this is also how they hold society back. And that is one of the end results of this book by Kinsella, is that the creation and the defense of copyright law and of patent law, it holds society back to an extent that we can't even comprehend. And that doesn't mean, none of this means that, so in the case of JSTOR, it doesn't mean that they can't hold all of these copies of different articles and books and, you know, PDFs, EPUBs, and then charge you to download them from their website, because of course it's costing them money to host these. They have to pay for power for these servers. They can do that. That is entirely possible. The argument against it is that that's not what they're doing. What they're doing is, if you don't pay them the fee, and these are exorbitant fees, they'll send some men in blue costumes to your house with guns. They will use guns and threat of death to take you down. And if you think I'm being melodramatic about it, just look up the story of Aaron Swartz. Look up the story of countless people who have been taken down for this sort of thing and who eventually were found dead in their cell or were shot to death by police simply for looking at something that a company like JSTOR claims that they don't own. But how can you own this? How can you own something? If you go to the Pirate Bay and download the latest movie, an ephemeral digital copy of something, of a piece of art, as it were, how can they say that that is something, that individual copy is ownable by anyone? It can be copied again. And this is also the foundation for the general public license and the Creative Commons licenses for the free software movement, because it also extends into the free software movement, which, by the way, I have created links on the website towards some free software that I have used and personally audited and enjoy quite a lot. But that's a side note. How the free software movement has fought the FSF, the EFF, that is the Free Software Foundation, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and there are many, many others. They all formed out of like-mindedness in the belief that software should be free, that something as transient as, or ephemeral as code should be free. And if you download the code, which is whenever you download a movie, all you're doing is downloading a bunch of ones and zeros. And these are not things that someone can own, because if you understand what a movie is on your hard drive, on your hard drive, something that you own, something that you have full control over, or you should, if you understand that, then you'll understand that all you're doing is capturing electrical impulses. You're capturing something that no one can really own. And then you're playing back this video. It's really quite simple, the argument for free software. The argument against copyright. The argument against patents. The argument against corporations, for that matter. In their very nature. And that's why, if I had a voice that someone in government would listen to, or that all of government would listen to, and if that voice could not take down the government by itself, but could influence it, I would ask, why do we even have the idea or the concept of corporation? And this is getting way off from the book, but at the same time, it is at the very core of this book. The whole concept of a corporation, the whole concept of a limited liability corporation, the whole concept of this idea of Google or Microsoft, and we look at them and we say Microsoft is this, and some people may associate it with a man, Bill Gates, but most people see it, and they see it as, oh, well, that's Microsoft. What is Microsoft? It is nothing. It is a word. It is an idea. But it isn't as if it is a human being who inherently, through their physicality, can control an object. It is an idea of a grouping of human beings, sure, but why don't you say, well, it is the board of Microsoft that owns these things, or the CEO of Microsoft. Well, you can't say that. You know why? Because then those people would be held responsible for any bad things that come from their software, from their ones and zeros, from their electrical impulses. Those people would be held responsible fully for anything that fails, anything that comes out of their work that fails. Oh, and by the way, the government can partner with a corporation like Microsoft, the U.S. government I'm talking about, and I'm sure others as well, but this is the only one I really truly know about on this level. They can partner with a corporation, a private, public-private partnership is what it's called. They could theoretically partner with an individual like Bill Gates, but they never do, because then Bill Gates would hold a certain amount of responsibility for his actions. Instead, they blame, oh, who remembers back, what, I don't even remember when it was, a long time ago, oh, it's probably been 20 years now, who remembers the fall of Enron? And we saw that Enron went under. And this is one of the only times that I've ever seen Enron going down, or a corporation going down, and their CEO going down with it, because they were finally able to stick something to the CEO of a company and the board. And finally, they were held responsible, but they're only held responsible for a small portion of the crimes committed by Enron. They're only held partially responsible. Now, they still went to prison, sure, but they were never held fully responsible for their crimes. And they never will be. No one ever will be. The only time I've ever seen in recent history, that a CEO or a board is held personally responsible for crimes is in Iceland, in the Icelandic Revolution in 2008 and 9, I believe. It might have been also 2010. When they basically took all of the banksters that bankrupted their country and were responsible for the bankrupting of the citizens of the country. And they actually put them in prison. They tore down their government, piece by piece, brick by brick, and set up a new government that seems, at least in this short run since, what has it been, 12 years maybe? 13? It seems that they are better off for it, because their government is much smaller. And of course, this is Iceland we're talking about, so it's they're not going to have a massive government in the beginning of it all. But it's funny how that transformation, where there is now so much less government control over individuals, that they're doing so much better and they're flourishing as a people, as a community, as it were. And so these are the things that I took away from this. I hope you don't mind that we went off the rails just a little bit. And by a little bit, of course, I mean completely off the rails from the topic of this book. But I hope you also see the connection I'm making between this idea of against intellectual property, this idea that Kinsella sets forth And I accept it. I've read the book twice now, and the second time, it was more of a refresher, but I also learned more, because I remembered more now. And I guess since this was my second time through, it kind of triggered all of these thoughts in my head about the formation of corporations and patents and so on, and the Free Software Foundation, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'll put links to all of those things as well in the description of the podcast, but I really just wanted to kind of use this moment and this idea, and hopefully you enjoyed this book, and if you haven't read it, I would strongly encourage you to read it, and then kind of come to this conversation that we're having right now, or this speech that I'm giving right now, I guess it is, this monologue, and make this into a dialogue. Come and find me on Mastodon. It's not that hard. Find an instance on Mastodon instance. The flagship instance is mastodon.social, or you can join us at dobbs.town. There are plenty of others, other servers that you can join. Come and find me on Mastodon, send me a message. You can send me an email, that's fine too. anarchobookclub@riseup.net, and I'll put that also in the description. I probably should be putting these things in every time from now on. But you can send me an email if you'd like. Send me a message on Mastodon. Let's talk about this. This is something that if you haven't noticed, I am relatively passionate about, because it touches on the free software movement, and it touches on the very core of our existence, the very thing that holds us all down, and that is the enforcement of amoral laws or amoral ideas by the biggest corporation of them all, the government. Because that's what the government is. It is just a corporation with limited liability. And they enforce these laws. They are the mafia that enforces their own set of rules upon us. Rules that are completely apart from our individual communities. So, well, I hope you enjoyed the book. And if you haven't yet, go ahead and read it, and I'm sure you will. And it is, if you've missed it through all of this, and if you've missed the title of this podcast, it is Against Intellectual Property by Stephen Kinsella. All right, so that concludes this part of the podcast, and now we discuss next week's book. So I recently went to a Half Price Books sort of near me and picked up a copy of On Language by Noam Chomsky. In that book, there are a couple of books, you might say, held within it. And the first one is the one that I wanted to read, and it is called Language and Politics by Noam Chomsky. Now, here's the problem. And this pertains to what we've been discussing today. The problem is, try as I might, I have not been able to find a free EPUB version, or PDF for that matter, version of this book online. If someone out there knows of one, or if someone out there has a copy of it in EPUB form, or MOBI form, or whatever format you have, I would love to get my hands on it. With that said, I think I'm going to go ahead and read this. It's about 100, and the copy I have, published by the New Press, it's about 194 pages long, I think, so it's not real long. Although, as I mentioned, if any of you listened to my interview on the GNU World Order podcast with Klaatu, I've read a lot of Chomsky. I've read this one as well, but it's been years, and it is a very dense book. Everything he writes is very dense. So, not bad. And it's not a bad thing at all. In fact, it's great. It'll give me lots of ammunition for the next podcast. But I don't know how to get this book to you, my dear listener and my dear fellow anarchists. I don't know how. Short of copying the whole thing down in text format and then sending it to you personally. So, if anyone out there knows, it would be very, very nice if you could send it to me via email or via Mastodon or however you choose to. Those are the only two ways I know of that you could send a file to me easily. So if anyone out there has a copy of it in any electronic form, please send it to me, and that way I can get it out to each and every one of you that is listening. But that's what we'll be reading. If you can find a copy, maybe... I've seen at least this compilation of the two or three books. What is it? There are three books combined, I believe. Maybe just two, I can't remember. All in this one volume. I've seen this volume at many used bookstores. There's a local library near me that sells some books that aren't checked out quite as often, and this is one of them, in fact. I just never bought it until now. I will put a picture up on Mastodon just so you can kind of see at least which copy I have, although I don't think they really differ as far as the content goes. But that is the book I think we will read for next week. And oh no, not I think. We will be reading that book for next week. Hopefully one of you has a copy in electronic format. Otherwise, and I don't want to commit to this, but otherwise I may... Well, we'll just see. I may try to see if I can copy it down. Maybe not. I don't know. I don't know if I want to commit to that. That is a lot of work. So, although that would be cool. I won't lie. That would be cool to have it in an EPUB form. So, anyway. So, that's what we'll be reading. If you don't have a copy, this is going to be a little bit more of an in-depth review. So... hopefully you kind of get the gist. I'm going to try my hardest not to go on my tangents and not to go on my little rants about different topics within this book. But any of you who know of Noam Chomsky, you know that he is also an anarchist. He is a very well-studied man, and he has a lot of really great ideas that have influenced me in so many different ways, just on language alone, because whenever I was studying languages and literature at university, he was responsible for a lot of my own developing philosophies at the time. Though I wasn't an anarchist, nor did I know he was an anarchist at the time, though I should have guessed, since he does have a book called On Anarchism. But that's what we'll be reading, and if one of you has a copy, again, I plead with you to send it to me, and hopefully we can get it out to any listener that requests it. So, so that's what we'll be reading. Oh, a little bit of news here. So I did contact my ISP, my internet service provider, and I try not to do that ever, but I did. And it turns out that I do, in fact, now have a static IP, which means maybe soon in the future I will be able to host this podcast from my home, which I think is a fantastic thing. I sure hope it is true. So I'm going to, and I'll run where I've got it now as backup for at least probably 6 months or a year, just in case. But if I'm satisfied with the stability of it running from my house, then I think that's what we're going to do from now on. And I will be completely decentralized, and this will be a truly decentralized website, anarchobook.club, or at least mostly truly. I guess I still have to register with a name server, but still, I don't really care about that right now. I'm just kind of excited that I may be able to truly self-host from my home. Which I've done in the past, but in the past I've already told you, I've had problems with the technology. But now I have a dedicated area for all of my networking equipment. So that's good news coming up soon, hopefully. Maybe even today if I can get it all set up, but we'll see. I still have to edit this, so we'll see how long that takes. I probably said a whole bunch. And a whole bunch. So that could take a long time. But anywho, that's the news, and that is the book we will be reading. I will put that out on Mastodon as well. And, oh, and here's another thing. So I see a lot of podcasts out there who, or that, I should say, not who. We have to start thinking of entities like a podcast or like a corporation, not as a who, but as an it, I believe. I see a lot of them out there building up these things that I'm not really interested in, but maybe it would be of interest to you, my dear anarchist listener. And that is an email list, a list of people that receive a weekly email, maybe as a reminder or as like a digest of what we talked about. And I just wondered if that at all sounds helpful to any of you. I do subscribe to a couple for blogs, namely Alien Bob's email list for his Slackware blog. And that's more to keep up to date with developments because he is deeply involved with the Slackware project. But I just wonder if it's useful. It is for me for that one blog. And there's one other as well, but for that specific blog, it is useful. But I didn't know what anybody else thinks about these things, if it's annoying. A lot of you do respond and you tell me this is actually really useful, I would like to set something like that up, like a weekly newsletter sort of thing, or maybe monthly or quarterly or whatever it is, just to kind of help keep you guys up to date on the state of the podcast and what we've covered so far. Maybe a quarterly one would be a good idea. What we've covered so far and kind of a Sparks Notes version, or is that what they call it? Yeah. A Sparks Notes version of each individual podcast topic. Something like that. And maybe even include in it attachments with the EPUB files and PDFs if we have those. Anyway, that's just a thought. I want to hear from you. Tell me what you think. I am going to be reaching out to other podcasters that I know and asking them what they think. And if it is something like a marketing gimmick that people do, which it very well could be, then I'm not going to do that. No, I'm just not going to. Because it's not about selling the podcast, or, it's not about selling the ideas of the podcast so much. It's more about, would it be useful, and would anyone be interested? If so, let me know, and we can make that happen. All right, so that's it for this installment of Anarcho Book Club. I'll see you guys next week.